Welcome to Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Larry Ostola. In 1995, Mike Harris and the Ontario Progressive Conservatives swept to power with a majority government promising action based on a policy platform known as the Common Sense Revolution. It was a manifesto for change that transformed the province. To walk us through some of those changes, I'm joined today by Alistair Campbell, the editor of a new volume entitled The Harris Legacy, Reflections on a Transformational Premier, published by Sutherland House in 2023. Alistair Campbell has served as CEO of a number of large Canadian insurance companies. A deep interest in public policy led him to volunteer in a variety of municipal, provincial, and federal election campaigns. In 1995, he worked on Mike Harris's successful provincial campaign in Ontario with responsibilities related to policy, communications, advertising, and media. Alistair, many thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for the opportunity, Larry.
So why don't we begin with the publication of the volume, Alistair? So clearly enough time has passed to be able to look back and assess the impact of the Harris years, but is it also fair to say that one of your objectives was to counter some of the negative narratives that seemed to linger regarding those years? Or as you put it in your introduction, the cancellation of reality?
So super fair question. The trigger was really the public announcement by current Premier Doug Ford of the appointment of Mike Harris to something called the Order of Ontario. And as you would expect, the normal critics of Harris, who were still alive, jumped back to it. The Toronto Star got into its normal full-throated unhappiness with any commemoration of this man and his legacy. That was normal. What struck me was that there were a group of younger journalists who I think must have been told by their editors to go and fill some column inches on the topic of Harris. And they dutifully did what good young reporters would do. They went to Google, they went to Wikipedia. And what they got was a rather narrow version of history. They got Walkerton and Ipperwash, and they got the idea of Harris as kind of an otherwise odd blip in the otherwise benign progressive trajectory of Ontario politics, and with misery and destruction in his wake. And he sold a highway for peanuts on the dollar to foreign interests. So that's kind of Wikipedia's version of Harris. And it struck me that, in the olden days, the history was written by the victors. In this case, it seems to be written by people other than Harris, who won two big majority governments, or maybe in retrospect, they were the victors. And so it was time to conduct a retrospective look. And so that was, mid-COVID, and on the side of my desk, the idea of maybe lining up a group of objective observers to take a look at different elements of the legacy kind of took shape. And I was blessed to be able to recruit an extraordinary and very generous group of folks who gave of their time as volunteers to do the research and write separate chapters in what turned out to be the Harris legacy.
So before we dive into the book, Alistair, why don't you just spend a few seconds taking us back to 1995 and give us a sense of it's been a while now, and give us a sense of the context for the Common Sense Revolution and the first election victory. What were the prevailing conditions in Ontario?
It's hard to imagine now, but it was awful. There were a lot of changes happening on the North American continent around globalization and deindustrialization, the transition to a services economy. That was happening everywhere. But in Ontario, We had had almost a decade of progressively deteriorating economic circumstances. We had $1.3 million on welfare. We had terrible levels, double-digit levels of unemployment. And there was an awful recession in 89-90 that lasted through to 93. And historically, Ontario had entered recessions last, reluctantly, kicking and screaming among Canadian provinces, and always came out first, leading Canada back to economic growth and prosperity. This time, Ontario came out last, behind Newfoundland. And by the time it came out, under Premier Bob Rae of the NDP, we had also peaked out at levels of annual deficit and total public debt that meant that debt interest expense was now the second largest budget item in the Ontario government. Rae had raised taxes multiple times, and revenue fell each time he did it. And there was suddenly a problem with the credit rating for Ontario, and debt wasn't just priced to be expensive. It was almost impossible to get new debt funded in Ontario between the burden of public spending and the burden of spending of Ontario Hydro, which was a hidden off the books additional liability that the investors in Wall Street certainly understood maybe better than the people of Ontario. It was a very difficult and very challenging time. And there was an appetite for major change, which is a key element of what Harris and the Common Sense Revolution spoke to.
Just on that point, so there was an appetite for change on the part of the electorate, but where did the Common Sense Revolution sit in terms of larger ideological currents of the day? There were reforms that were taking place elsewhere. Where did the platform sit in that context?
Yeah, so there's actually a chapter on this, Antecedents to the Revolution, that covers exactly your question and speaks exactly to where you're coming from, which is that we did not make this out of a whole cloth. We were drawing on intellectual currents globally. And so there were big influences from the thinking around the role of government and the size of the public sector relative to the private sector that was coming from Prime Minister Thatcher in England. There was a very strong impetus for thinking around levels of taxation and high marginal tax rates having adverse impacts on productivity and innovation and entrepreneurial activity and economic growth. There were also a lot of rethinking about the design of government itself. New Zealand was a huge influence. Prime Minister Longy was doing very innovative things around kind of merit pay for high performing public sector employees, for instance. And in America, you saw Vice President Gore talking about reinventing government. And you saw President Clinton taking quite firm action on things like welfare. And all of those were contributing factors into what turned out to be the policy content of the Common Sense Revolution platform.
Well, and just on that, you make the point in the introduction that in terms of content, scope, and specificity, the platform, the Common Sense Revolution platform, breached many political norms. What did you mean by that?
I defy you, Larry, to remember the content of any other Canadian political platform. I would say even the one that had the most influence on the strategic thinking behind the development of the CSR, as it became known, the Chrétien Red Book, you certainly remember its color, but you cannot remember any of its content. It was quite thick, but the content was directional and rhetorical. The Common Sense Revolution, by contrast, was only 24 pages. It had a detailed list of assumptions around the econometric model underpinning its assumptions about what could be done if tax rates were cut by a precise amount and if government spending was cut by a precise amount, and the timeline in which the budget would be balanced and specific plans for reductions to welfare rates with a number attached, and specific numbers attached to a whole list of other commitments that were made with very clear policy intent laid out in detail. In the debate between opposition leader Lynn McLeod of the Liberals and Premier Ray, Harris held up the platform and said, there's 2.5 million copies printed. I encourage you to get one for yourself, read it for yourself, do the math, and I will resign if I don't keep the promises in this platform. That was the moment he won the election. I was in a room with focus group people turning the knobs, and that was the moment where they turned it to 11. They couldn't have been more excited to hear a politician committing to actual change and committing to it with specifics and committing to it with an intent to deliver that wasn't just rhetorical or a promise made in the hectic flourish of a campaign.
There were parts of the platform that figured centrally in it. I mean, if you talk about things like reductions in spending and taxation, they were well known and well communicated. But there were others that gained prominence later, such as the reform of the energy sector and the breakup of Ontario Hydro. And in fact, one initiative that became quite well known, the creation of the Bruce Power Public-Private Partnership. Was this by accident or design?
So I think it would be fair to say that there's energy in a couple of the other policy areas where the initial policy decision led to a series of future decisions, not all of which were understood at the time. I think that would be fair to say in the case of energy. It was very clear that Ontario Hydro had been a key contributor to the competitive advantage of Ontario over decades. That allowed us to build a strong manufacturing base, an integrated component of a North American industrial platform, including the huge contribution to the North American auto sector from Canada. All of this was enabled by Ontario Hydro's lower cost of power. Suddenly, all of that was no longer the case. The massive cost overruns for Pickering and then Darlington left Ontario with this huge contingent unfunded liability in public debt to fund the cost overruns for nuclear. And it was very clear that the Ontario Hydro that we had inherited wasn't going to be fit for purpose. And so the deconstruction was an outcome of policy realities, current status quo not working. The commitment had simply been to kind of get Hydro back to being a competitive advantage with affordable rates for consumers. The outcomes led to extraordinarily successful things like the breakup of Ontario Hydro's monolith into separate, more focused areas of transmission and generation. The Bruce Power I think the idea of privatizing nuclear power probably was one of the most extraordinary successes of Harris. And the fact that he could do that and get it done successfully, really interesting. In retrospect, hard to imagine. It was not specifically in the platform, but it was a logical outcome of the commitments in the platform.
Another area which didn't really jump out of the CSR initially was healthcare reform, but it was to become a major issue. And there's a chapter in the book on it that really highlights how effective and systematic the approach to reform was. In fact, the author points out a really interesting contradiction. He says, like, we've got a group that's supposedly made up of all these free market revolutionaries engaging in what he describes as central planning. Walk us through this. Because it sounds a little odd.
So it is one of the most brilliant chapters in the book, and not surprising because it's written by Will Falk, who's one of the most brilliant Canadians we've got, and a good liberal, and a healthcare expert over decades. And when he dug into the research for this, what he found, the final sentence I think still ringing in the ears of quite a few liberals, Mike Harris was a good healthcare premier. Is not in Wikipedia, and should be. But the problem that was kind of facing Harris was that we had this complete transition in the way medicine was working and how that connected to the role of hospitals. And that was a transition that was happening throughout the Western world. And that transition was that surgeries were getting better and more scientific, and people did not need to spend days in hospital recovering afterwards. And so the demand for hospital beds was changing dramatically. Everywhere else in the world, some form of market mechanisms were engaged to adjust the number of hospital beds. In state-run healthcare Canada, and particularly in state-run healthcare Ontario, we just kept building more hospitals because they were politically powerful and politicians enjoyed the opportunity to cut the ribbon. And so what needed to be done in Ontario was the closure of a whole series of almost 40 small, often rural, and economically completely inefficient hospitals, and the money needed to be reallocated. And nobody had the political fortitude to make decisions like that previously. And Harris just was the kind of leader ready to make those changes. So the hospitals were closed. The money was reinvested in the super regional hospitals that we have today and in a massive investment in the specialty corridor of super hospitals down University Avenue in Toronto, which serves the whole province and in some portions, parts of the country. The decisions were made in Harris. The ribbons were cut under Liberals elected afterwards. They enjoyed the applause as they cut ribbons that were only possible because of the brave political leadership of Harris to close the hospitals that made no economic sense. Those are special examples of the kind of leadership Harris showed and beautifully articulated in a respectful way by a good Liberal, but a real expert on healthcare in Will Falk.
Getting to another area that that emerged during that first administration, there were major reforms to Ontario's social assistance system, and a key focus was on a reduction in the number of welfare beneficiaries. What was the thinking behind the reforms, and I'm sure they were not uncontested. What was the result?
So, if people think back to that time, it's almost hard to imagine now that we had 1.3 million on welfare in a province that was not yet 11 million people. Welfare was one of the top three issues mentioned in every ad during the campaign. And the commitment was mandatory work for welfare. There was a very strong sense that there needed to be a kind of return to balance around the generosity of welfare benefits. And there was a risk that was understood by the electorate that it was more attractive to be on welfare than it was to work. The announcement of mandatory work for welfare happened as soon as Harris was elected, with a commitment to reduce benefits for able-bodied single people to 10% above the national average of the other provinces. So it was still the most generous in Canada, but it was less generous. Welfare consumption started falling the next month, and it fell every month for the 6.5 years that Harris was premier and returned to the much more reasonable levels, 500,000 or so, that it was at the end of his time. It was a dramatic change. In the end, I think, regardless of your partisan views, the best solution to welfare dependency is a job. And there was a massive burst of job creation, partly at least because of the Harris tax cuts and the return to fiscal sanity with balanced budgets. But there was also a very clear sense that it was going to be worth your while to go look for work. And if you couldn't find a job, you were going to have to at least do something in exchange for your benefits. Those were hugely popular policies. They were also hugely effective policies. And the number of people who returned to work thanks to these changes, I think Mike would tell you is one of his proudest accomplishments.
Some might also be surprised to learn that that there were also some pretty significant environmental gains that were made during the Harris years. And we'll get into the effect the premier had on that a little later. But some of the things that happened were the conservation of the Oak Ridges Moraine, the creation and expansion of provincial parks through something called Ontario's Living Legacy, the beginning of the end of coal-fired power generation, and the Drive Clean Tailpipe Emissions Program. How did environmental conservation emerge as a priority and assume such significance?
So that chapter's covered primarily by Gordon Miller, who was the first Environment Commissioner of Ontario, a role created by Harris. And Gordon Miller was reappointed under, I think, McGuinty and Wynne. He was, and I believe he ran Green in the last federal and provincial elections. So he's definitely not your standard bred Tory partisan. His description of the gut instincts of a northerner, which Mike Harris was, and the idea that, you know, you were kind of bonded with nature as part of growing up in the north, I think it's absolutely clear that Harris was an old-fashioned progressive conservative in this regard. And the environment is something you tend for future generations. And so dealing with smog, working out how to manage the conservation authorities more effectively, creating the largest expansion in parkland, I think, in the history of the world, and becoming the first jurisdiction on Earth to get to the 12% of your land mass designated as parkland, which is a United Nations biodiversity target. Nobody did this with as firm a hand and as clear a vision as Harris. And a key theme that emerged in this book, chapter over chapter, was that notwithstanding the controversies of the time, almost nothing Harris did was reversed. And the Oak Ridges Moraine is a beautiful example of that. All that Dalton McGuinty did was bravely rename it the Green Belt, but the bravery to create it and have the impact that it did on private property rights was a Harris decision. And as Premier Ford has discovered, not even that element of the Harris legacy is reversible. The protection of the Oak Ridges Moraine is pretty much hard-coded into the system and is another powerful example of the Harris legacy.
Well, and there's an anecdote in the book that I have to ask you about. Just there was a large group of people working on environmental protection and the creation of conservation areas, conservation lands, and so on. And a target of 12% had been set in terms of the lands that would be set aside. And at one point, the group, after a lot of arguing and debating, came up with a plan that amounted to 9%, and they brought it to Premier Harris. You finish off the anecdote.
What about 12% didn't you understand? Mike was a firm leader, and he was also a deep student of public policy. He'd sat on the back benches during that Bill Davis era and watched carefully. There was no public policy file that he didn't understand inside and out, including the stakeholder map. And getting to the expansion of parkland that was the final result of Ontario's Living Legacy was a big stretch target. And it had huge tensions between environmentalist activists and folks with an appetite for development and natural resource exploitation. To get to the 12% required a very firm hand. And he delivered exactly the leadership that was required in that case.
So, and I'd like to now really zoom in on that point that we've been buzzing around over the course of our conversation. In the book, Jamie Watt really makes a compelling case that the premier's northern Ontario background, along with principles like fairness to individuals and equality of opportunity for all, were key to his success. So, In that context, what's your assessment and how would you describe the personal impact of Mike Harris and his leadership style?
So I think Jamie's beautiful description of Harris, I think speaks to a couple of issues that surfaced in Jamie's research. And I think all of us who were involved in this project were surprised. I never had on my list of the Harris legacy, you know, major advances in LGBTQ rights in Canada. But it turned out to be just another on a long list of things where Harris firmly grasped the nettle and made the decisions that others haven't been brave enough to. So what made, and the huge expansion in the arts and culture institutions of Greater Toronto, and the opera and the ballet and the massive expansions of the ROM and the AGO. I don't think the arts community were big backers of Mike. But Mike somehow understood as a northerner that Ontario only prospered if Toronto prospered. And that was good for all of Ontario. So these were all elements of personality profile. But the first thing I think that I would say about Harris's leadership style is that it was quite special in a way that's very foreign to most of us. Mike was totally comfortable if you underestimated him. Larry, if you and I go and play poker, there's always this rule that you're supposed to look around and work out who the patsy is. And if you can't work it out, that means it's you. People were ready to profile Mike from the get-go as a dumb golf pro from North Bay. And Mike didn't mind if that's what they thought, because it gave him a competitive advantage, because he knew that he was much better than that. But if they wanted to underestimate him, he was cool. So one of the tremendous assets of Harris was his ability to just let other people make assumptions and then outperform expectations. And that is a very important, I think, attribute of his leadership style. The other one that I would just flag is that Mike was always ready to make long-term decisions if he was sure they were right, even if they had short-term adverse political consequences. We are recording this just after the weekend with the funeral of former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. And I think it's another example of a highly consequential political leader who made long-term and beneficial decisions that had awful short-term political consequences for him and his party, but were the right thing for Canada. Harris had exactly that same kind of internal compass and confidence in his own capabilities, even if he was underestimated by others, to make long-term, firm, and permanent binding decisions that he thought were of benefit to the province. And the consequences are a legacy that has largely not been reversed.
Well, and that Alistair, is a perfect segue to the next point that I wanted to raise, which is that in the book, one of the key conclusions is that based on the evidence and the fact that so many of the changes that were introduced remain in place, it's not an exaggeration to say that today we're living in Mike Harris's Ontario. Is what you've been referring to, is imitation by subsequent governments the sincerest form of flattery in this case?
So first, you know, that legacy and the idea that we're living in Harris's Ontario was an outcome of all of the different authors' contributions to this book. You know, the city of Toronto was not unmerged. The monolith of Ontario Hydro was not reconstituted. Nobody subsequently put welfare compensation rates in Ontario back to the far too high levels of David Peterson and Bob Rae's era. Standardized testing in the schools, grade 3, grade 6, grade 9, with published results by school, and a literacy test before you graduate. The centralization of negotiation between the province and the very powerful teachers' unions. The Oak Ridge's moraine. The list of policy areas where Harris's decisions have proven to be binding and permanent was chapter after chapter, pretty long. But I don't know that imitation is flattery is quite the right way to think of it. You know, policy, public policy is kind of a continuum over time. And you tackle the problems that are on your desk when you come to power. The folks who replaced Harris didn't need to fix things that Harris had already fixed. So they left welfare rates where they were. They didn't reopen those 40 hospitals. They left the city of Toronto to become this big North American success story that it is today. And they went on to tackle other issues that they thought were more important. So it wasn't so much imitation as you solve the problems in front of you. And most of the problems Harris tackled were big ones. And he made permanent, lasting, and beneficial changes. And McGuinty and Wynn could move on to other files.
And so you just mentioned public policy being a continuum or on a continuum. And with that in mind, do you think, based on your work on the book and the contributions of all the authors and so on, is there a lesson or a message that we should take away from the Mike Harris years in Ontario that applies to our current context? Is there something that people should be paying attention to or something that they should be thinking about?
Well, I think it'd be fair to say that there is a pretty broad consensus that Canada could do with a strategy and that our economic performance has now over some decades deteriorated relative to competitors, not just the U.S., but throughout the developed world. Our productivity has collapsed. There isn't enough investment in capital. There's excessive investment in residential real estate instead. And our foreign policy has become rudderless, and we're weak on the international stage. There's just a long list of things in Canada where leadership would be a good thing to get. You're watching now the new conservative leader using the brand Common Sense regularly. His last convention was the Common Sense Convention. He's using Common Sense as a standard term in all of his marketing rhetoric. And by itself, just using the brand, I think Harris illustrates powerfully, isn't enough. It has to have content underlying it. People will listen to your marketing slogans, but what they're really interested in is the product. Harris really illustrates that in a time with great political turmoil and high levels of economic distress, intelligent voters, which is the substantial plurality, will make informed decisions and make the right decisions if they're given policy content that makes sense. And so I think Harris's arrival at a time of crisis in Ontario with a clear platform, with content, is why people remember the marketing now. What makes Harris special was that he wasn't just a populist with a slogan. He was a politician with a plan and a roadmap for where Ontario had to go. And I think all Canadians would welcome political leadership that gets a little bit more forthright about what's the content of their roadmap and where precisely do we need to go to get to a better place.
Well, Alistair, with that, I really want to thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
I appreciate the opportunity, Larry. Thanks.
My guest today was Alistair Campbell. His book, The Harris Legacy: Reflections on a Transformational Premier, was published by Sutherland House in 2023. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca. The best way you can support this podcast is by becoming a subscribing member of the Champlain Society. If you like what you've heard, let your friends know by forwarding this podcast through the social media of your choice. You can also send us an email at info@champlainsociety.ca. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society, who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We want to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Larry Ostola. This interview was recorded on March 26, 2024. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt and supported by the University of Toronto Press Journal team, who also support the Champlain Society.